So there's a story about one of the great Indian masters, one of the Mahasiddhas called Naropa, which I'm sure quite a few of you will have heard before. But when I said to Surita that I wanted to start studying Sanskrit at university, he told me this story. So Naropa was the head of this great Buddhist university in Nalanda. So a very accomplished scholar. And one day he was sitting in the library studying, and suddenly this, you know, hideous old crone appears, and he's very taken aback by this figure that appears to him. And she says, "You know, what are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm studying, you know, grammar and epistemology and Buddhist philosophy." And she says, "Do you understand the words or the meaning?" He says, "Well, I understand the words." And she's delighted, and she laughs and claps her hands and says, "You know, this is wonderful." And he thinks, "Well, you know, she's so pleased." He says, "Well, I understand the meaning as well." And her face falls, and she starts, you know, gnashing her teeth and crying, and she's very distraught. And Naropa says to her, "Well, you know, what's going on? Why were you so pleased when I said I understood the words, and so upset when I said I understood the meaning?" And she said, "Well, I thought I'd finally found a scholar who had the humility to admit that he understood the words but not the meaning." So this is my teaching from Surita in terms of going into a more academic approach to Buddhism. And so I've always had that kind of story with me. And that's one of the things that I've enjoyed so much about working with Ratnaguna. You know, we worked on the Sukhavadibhuha Sutras together and produced the book Great Faith, Great Wisdom. And it's why I was so keen to work with him again on this text. Because when we've been, you know, when we're collaborating on the book, we would kind of, you know, send our text back and forth. I would send him my translation, he would send me the commentary, and we would kind of, I would be able to explain some of the words to him, you know, the connotations and the linguistic subtleties. And, you know, in his commentary, he was able to kind of open up the text and help me to understand the meaning of the text in a much deeper way. So we haven't collaborated, we haven't discussed, "Well, I'll talk about this and you talk about this." But my thought was that I'm going to let Ratnaguna talk about the meaning, and I'll stick to talking about the words. Because I think I understand a bit of the meaning, but not nearly as much as Ratnaguna. So what I want to talk about this evening is a bit about the process of translation, about how translation works, and the kind of things that we should be aware of when we're reading a text which is a translation. I also want to talk a little bit about Khonsa and his translation of the text, because if any of you have you know, read the text prior to coming here, it's most likely Khonsa's translation that you've read. So I want to explain some of the differences in approach and why the two translations are different. And I particularly want to talk about the idea of paradox and contradiction in the Perfection of Wisdom, because there's an idea, a view of the Perfection of Wisdom that's very widespread in the movement and in the Buddhist world more generally, that the Perfection of Wisdom texts are illogical. They're kind of non-rational, even anti-rational. And that's an idea that's been questioned by scholars more recently. And so I want to kind of draw out a bit of that and draw out some of the, an alternative way of approaching some of these statements that appear to be contradictory. So an important thing to bear in mind in terms of translation, that you can't translate literally. A lot of people who haven't translated, particularly, you know, like most English speakers are monolingual, think, well, you know, you have a word in this language and you look it up in the dictionary, you don't know what it means, and it means this thing in another language. So it's quite straightforward. You just literally translate it, you know, from one language into the other. But that language doesn't work like that. An example that really struck me when I was doing translation studies at University College London, one of the lecturers gave this example of the word butter in English and the equivalent word in Italian, which I think is burro. And you would think, well, you know, okay, maybe some philosophical concepts is a bit hard to translate, but if it's a physical substance, you can point to it. You get an English speaker to point to it and they say butter, you get an Italian person to point to the same thing and they say burro. So obviously, butter and burro, it's the same word, it has the same meaning. But in fact, if you look at the cultural context, in England, butter is something luxurious, it's something you put on bread, it's kind of it's something, you know, kind of high quality. Whereas in Italy, the foodstuff that plays that role is olive oil. You know, olive oil is the stuff that's good quality, that's luxury, that you put in your bread. Butter is this kind of cheap stuff that you just use for cooking. So in a literary context, in a context where, you know, an author is using butter to signify something, you know, if it's an English text being translated into Italian, butter might have completely the wrong connotations, the wrong associations. So you might have to translate butter as olive oil. So that's just a little practical example to do with something physical. And so when we're talking about, you know, abstract concepts and dharmic ideas, then it's much more complicated. So any translation involves interpretation. You're not reading the original text. What you're reading is what the translator thinks the original text says. And so if you're reading my translation, you're reading what I think the text means. And when you're reading Konza's translation, you're reading what Konza thinks the text means. So that's why it's important to read translations critically. It's important to bear that in mind. And I think in Ratnaguna's talk earlier, we got a very good example of that. He was going through the first line of verse 1 and these three words, prema, gaurava, and prasada. And especially with prasada, there's so many different meanings, you know, and he mentioned a couple of alternative ways it could have been translated. So, you know, if you could have prema as love or affection or passion even, reverence could be, gaurava could be reverence or respect, as Konza had it. And of course, prasada has at least 10 different translations. So, you know, you've got there probably a, you know, 50 different possibilities of translations, and I've chosen one of them. I've chosen the one that I think is the most appropriate. But that's what you're reading. You're not reading what the text actually says. If you're reading it in Sanskrit, then when you read prasada, it would have all these associations if you're a Sanskrit speaker. But when you read my translation, you're reading serene faith, and that has a whole different network of connotations. And that's the kind of network of connotations I reckon is best, but that's my judgment. That's my interpretation of the text, and it needs to be engaged with critically. Which is why it's always good to know a little bit of Sanskrit and be able to use a Sanskrit dictionary and, you know, look things up. So that's one issue of translation is interpretation. Another issue is that there's a paradox at the heart of any translation, which is that translation is impossible. You can't translate anything, because, you know, any word in any particular language, it doesn't exist in isolation. It's part of the whole. You know, it's conditioned arising. You know, the words and ideas and concepts get their meaning as part of a context, the whole context of a language and a culture. And any time you translate any text from one language to another, you're moving from one network of connotations and ideas and beliefs and values that underlie the language to a completely different one, a completely foreign one. So anytime you translate anything, the translator will add things to the translation. There will be things in the translation that were not present in the original text, and there will be things in the original text that get lost in translation. Yeah, we can't actually translate anything, but at the same time, we have to translate things. There's this wonderful little story in the Pali Canon where there's these two monks who used to be Brahmins, and they come to the Buddha and say, wouldn't it be a good idea to put your teachings into Vedic, into like proper Sanskrit, you know, so it's properly codified. And but this was kind of the language of the elite. This was the language of the Brahmins. And the Buddha kind of tells them off and calls them witless fools and says, you know, people need to hear the Dharma in their own language, you know, or in their own dialect, their own tongue. So we do need to translate. at the same time as it's impossible to translate. And this links into the idea in the first few verses of the text that Ratnaguna was talking about today, that all Dharma teaching comes from the same source, it all comes from the Buddha. So if you've, as it says, if you're teaching what you've practiced and realized, as it says in verse 4, then even if you're teaching in a different language, it's still the same Dharma. But that means that the qualification for being a translator of Buddhist texts is a very high one. You not only have to have the linguistic skills to be able to translate, you have to have, if you're not enlightened, then you have to be pretty close. You have to have a direct experience of the Dharma personally in order to be able to properly translate it. You have to really understand what you're translating in order to be sure that you're communicating in a different language in the right way. So I possess the linguistic qualification to a reasonable extent, but I certainly make no claim to possess the spiritual qualification, which is why it's again good to work with Ratnaguna, who has much more experience of Dharma practice to draw on and much more understanding. There's a lot of the text I understand, but there are places where the Sanskrit's fairly clear. I mean, I can translate what the Sanskrit says, but I don't really understand what it means. And then I kind of notice the feeling of being on thin ice, and that I should really do another 40 or 50 years of meditation before I try and translate this text. But that's balanced with the fact that we do need new translations, and, you know, there is a need to actually do it. So there's always that paradox and that feeling of imperfection that I think any Buddhist translator will experience. So my approach to translating Buddhist texts, I think Ratnaguna this morning characterised it as understandable and true Ratna-friendly English. Because any translation is an interpretation of the original text, the fact that, you know, I've practiced within true Ratna for many years, my way of interpreting the text, my way of understanding the text, is very much affected by Sangharaksha's approach, by the way of practicing, the way of conceiving and framing the Dharma that we have in true Ratna. At the same time, in any Buddhist movement or any spiritual movement in general, there is a certain amount of jargon that builds up. You know, I mean, I'm sure you'll have, if you've been around the movement for a long time, you're so used to it you probably don't notice it. But for those of you who are a bit newer, you're probably hearing people using words and expressions that you don't quite get, and, you know, it's like, I'm sure that must mean something specific, but you don't, if it's not explained to you, you don't understand what it means. And to an extent, that's inevitable, because we do need a technical vocabulary in order to talk about the particular ideas and concepts that we need to use in order to explain the Dharma and practice the Dharma. You know, there are ways of thinking that we don't have words for in our ordinary everyday English language. But there are, I mean, there's one example I want to give, which is the word skanda, which we tend to just use the Sanskrit word skanda. And I think that can often be a way of slightly skating over the fact that we don't quite really understand what a skanda is. We kind of know it's this list of five things, but what a skanda actually is, we're maybe not that clear on, but we just kind of say skanda. So I've thought quite a bit about how to translate this. And the word skanda literally means a heap or a pile. And the way that the Buddha talks about the skandas in the Pali Canon is that you should meditate on your experience, and everything you experience, you should be able to sort into one of these five piles: of form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. And so there's nothing left over. There's nothing in your experience that doesn't fit into one of these five piles. And it's a way of showing that there is no Atman, there is no essential self, there's nothing apart from these five skandhas. So based on that, I thought, well, a pile, and that's, it's a kind of physical metaphor, but what the Buddha's talking about is categorization. You're categorizing your experiences. So in the translation here and elsewhere, I've called them the categories of experience, the five categories of experience. So that's not that's my own translation. It's not a Triratna term. But by using it, I'm hoping to kind of provoke you to think a little bit about, well, what is a skanda? Because it's a new translation. When you read it, you'll be like, oh, categories of experience, that's interesting. That must be the skandas. And go a little bit deeper into thinking about what the skandas actually mean. Something else that I think is very important in translating in general, and particularly in terms of translating Buddhist texts from Sanskrit, is to use good English. And that might seem obvious, but there's a tradition of translating Sanskrit into English, particularly within academia, which translates it in a very literal way. And I've studied Sanskrit at university, and this is something I find quite difficult, that if you have a Sanskrit exam, you're expected to translate it in a very literalistic way, where you basically follow the Sanskrit sentence structure. And I've even been marked down for not doing this. And Konza takes this approach. And I think it's one of the things that mean that a lot of Buddhists don't really read Buddhist texts. And I think that's one of the things that's a great shame. And it's also quite strange. It's not unusual to find a Buddhist who says, oh yeah, I'm really into the Dharma and the Buddhist teachings, but yeah, like the Pali texts and Mahayana sutras, yeah, I can't be bothered with that. It's too difficult. It'd be much more unusual to find a Christian who says, yeah, I'm really into Christianity and Jesus, but the Bible, it's a bit dry. I'm not going to deal with that. But I think a lot of the problem is that a lot of translations of Buddhist texts were done by academics, basically for other academics. They weren't done to be read by non-specialists, and so the language is very dry. And you get these Sanskritized sentences. There's a very famous article that talks about this called Buddhist Hybrid English, and Konza's approach very much typifies this Buddhist Hybrid English. I'm not going to mention Buddhist Hybrid Sanskrit, which is a mixture of classical Sanskrit and the more kind of everyday language of the Prakrits, but Buddhist Hybrid English is it's something to be avoided. It's English in its vocabulary, but in terms of the way that things are expressed and the structure of the sentences, it's Sanskritized, which makes it a lot harder to understand. So I wanted to just give a little example of this from verse 4. So yeah, so the first two lines of verse 4, Konza has, for whatever the Jinnah has taught, the guide to the Dharma, his pupils, if genuine, have been well trained in it. So this follows, this is the way that the Sanskrit sentence is structured. So in English you normally have the subject, the verb and the object, like the man saw a dog. And here the idea is basically the disciples have been trained in the Dharma that the Buddha taught. So you've got the pupils or the disciples as the subject, and then the verb is trained, and then the object is what the Dharma that the Buddha taught. And that's the logical, the natural English way of expressing it. In Sanskrit it's very common to put the object first and then the subject and then the verb. But when we read a sentence like that, we can understand it in English, but we have to put effort into kind of decoding the foreign sentence structure. So when I translated it, I reorganized the sentence. I've changed the order that the elements come in to make it more natural English. So my version is, those who are true disciples of the Buddha amongst human beings have practiced the teachings of the victorious one, the guide in the Dharma. And so one of the reasons I think this is important is, if you're reading Buddhist hybrid English, you're having to be up in your head much more. You're having to use your intellect to decode and try and work out what the text is trying to say. And this text is difficult enough anyway. And I think by clearing away this kind of Sanskritized syntax, the Sanskritized sentence structure, and putting the sentences into more natural English, it's easier to get into the text. It's easier to let the text have an impact on you and affect you emotionally. And I think it's really important when we're talking about Dharma texts that when we read them, they can inspire us, they can speak to our emotions, they can move us, and we're not just having to use our heads all the time. Another kind of minor point is to do with gender, that I think, you know, norms and ideas around gender are, you know, in changing a lot, especially in the last 5 years or so. It's becoming much more mainstream to understand that gender is not, you know, binary, one or the other. And there are more and more people, especially younger people, who are feeling more comfortable saying, well, actually, you know, the kind of traditional gender norms don't really fit me. I've deliberately made my translation gender neutral. So I've used the pronoun they as a to talk about the bodhisattva rather than he. And, you know, some people might be critical of this because in Sanskrit does use male pronouns to talk about everyone. But I think if we do that in English today, if we say, well, you know, if a bodhisattva does this, then he should experience this or he should have this result, it sounds to us as if we're just talking about men, as if we're excluding women or anyone who doesn't identify as male. And I don't really believe that that was what the text intended. I think it's a linguistic convention from, you know, 2,500 years ago to use the male pronoun to talk about people in general. And we can't do that in English today anymore. So I think it's necessary to change the pronoun usage. And another example is the bull among human beings. And in the text, it's Narashaba, which is the bull among men. But I've deliberately changed it to make it more inclusive. So again, this is my interpretation of the text. And you're welcome to engage with that critically. But I thought it was worth mentioning. So I want to talk a little bit about Konza. And before I start kind of criticising him, I just wanted to talk a little bit appreciatively about him. Because at the time that Konza was working, I mean, the resources that he had available to study these texts and the amount of, you know, there'd been very little research done on them before. And he, you know, edited the Sanskrit of all of the whole of the Perfection of Wisdom and translated them all into English, which was not his native language. So, you know, he's made this huge effort, and it's a huge achievement what he did at that time with the resources he had available to him. So even though, you know, research on the Perfection of Wisdom and you know, Mahayana Buddhism has moved on since his time, that in ways that I think mean we need to revise his interpretations and his approach. You know, his achievement is still very impressive, and I think you know, we should all be very grateful to him. But in terms of going back to this idea that all translation is an interpretation, when we read Konza's translation of the Perfection of Wisdom, what we're reading is Konza's interpretation of those texts. And Konza had very particular and quite strong ideas about the Prajnaparamita, about what it meant. And those beliefs coloured his interpretation, and it coloured the way that he interpreted the Sanskrit. Particularly in terms of his belief that these texts were using paradox, that they were non-rational, that there were elements in the texts that were not intended to make sense, that were not intended to be rationally comprehensible. We get a bit of this in the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata. It's much more of an issue in texts like the Diamond Sutra. And Jayarava has written two very good articles about this idea of paradox and contradiction and the way that Collins interpreted the Diamond Sutra and more recent research on it. So one's called The Use of Negation in Vajracchedika, which is the Diamond Sutra, and the other one's called Nonsense and Nonsensibility. So if you're interested in this issue, I'd very much recommend going to Jayarava's blog, and if you just, there's a tag for, you know, there's tags for various subjects. If you just click on the Vajracchedika tag. I think there's four articles in the Vajracchedika, and these ones on negation and nonsense are two of them. So he explains it very well and kind of summarises some of the more recent research by Paul Harrison and Richard Jones. Just to mention Richard Jones, there aren't a lot of translations of the Ratnaguna Sanjayagata. Collins's is the one we're most familiar with because it's the one that Bhante used, and it's in Wisdom Beyond Words. But this book here, by Richard H. Jones, The Heart of Buddhist Wisdom, this contains a translation of the Ratnaguna Sanjayagata and quite a few of the other shorter Prajnaparamita texts. So his translations are a bit quirky. He uses quite a lot of technical language, so they're not very readable. But, you know, in terms of every translation being a translation of that particular translator's interpretation of the text, if you want to study a text like this without learning Sanskrit, which is the best, I would recommend learning Sanskrit, by the way. It's fantastic. It's great fun. It is hard, but it's so much fun that kind of, you know, compensates for it. So if any of you want to learn Sanskrit, just come and talk to me afterwards and I'll give you some tips. But short of learning Sanskrit, you know, reading as many different translations as you can get hold of is the best approach, because you will then get, you know, different translators' perspective, different translators' interpretations of the same text, which will give you a bit of a more nuanced picture. And there's a very good little article, a few pages at the end of that book, where Jones talks about this idea of paradox and contradiction in the Prajnaparamita. So quite a lot of what I'm going to say now is taken from Jayaratha and from Richard Jones and Paul Harrison. So yeah, Konza had this idea that the texts were using paradox and contradiction, whereas I and these other eminent scholars I've mentioned would dispute that. So there's a couple of examples. I mean, you get this all the time in the Diamond Sutra, but there's a couple of examples here in chapter 2 of the Ratnaguna Sanjayagata. So it's verse 3 and verse 7 in chapter 2. So if we take verse 3, particularly the last line. The guide does not base himself in the realm of the unconstructed, nor in the realm of the constructed, but wanders homeless. A bodhisattva bases themselves on this state of not basing oneself on anything. The victorious one uses the word state in this way, to mean a state which is no state. That seems like a very clear contradiction, a state which is no state. It's both a state and a not a state. So that's a logical contradiction, a logical impossibility. And then in verse 7, the last line, they train in the training which is no training. This is their training. I'm not sure I'm completely happy with the translation I've got. This was, I sent off the translation to Sanganishta on Sunday morning as I was travelling, and then I was kind of thinking about it and reading through it again on the plane and the train here, and it was these two verses. Like, oh no, I have to change that. And, so I sent a new version. Unfortunately, I haven't printed it out yet. But I mean, this seems quite straightforward, the lack of contradiction. This seems like, you know, what Konza and Bhante are characterising as you know, nonsense, as non-rational. But I think it's an important principle when you're reading a text to assume that the author intended for their text to make sense. They intended for the text to be understood by their readers. So if we don't understand this, our first approach should be to think not that this text was intended not to be understood, but to think that, well, I haven't understood the text. So if this kind of thing isn't contradiction, then what could it mean? And I think we have a couple of clues if we look earlier in the text at verse 5 of chapter 1. It says, in this practice, no highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. No state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, nor any awakening mind. A bodhisattva who can hear this, without becoming confused or afraid, is practicing the wisdom of the Sugatas. So this is, I think, a slightly easier to understand way of... this explanation is... saying the same kind of thing as the parts that seem to be directly contradictory, but in a way that's a bit more accessible. So what the text here is really saying, that there is no perfection of wisdom, there is no state of bodhisattva, there is no awakening mind. That doesn't mean we should just give up and go home, that there's no point to what we're doing. I mean, I don't think any of us would interpret it in that way. But what it means is, you know, the awakening mind, the state of bodhisattva, the perfection of wisdom, it's not a thing you can get hold of. It's not some kind of transcendental object. What it's saying is that, yeah, we talk about these things, we use these terms, but, you know, don't fixate on them. Don't think that they're anything other than part of the network of causes and conditions. You know, they exist. They are conditionally arisen. And it's a similar point in verse 13. Immature people mistakenly imagine things that do not exist and make the non-existent existent in their minds. Neither existence nor non-existence are in accord with the Dharma. A bodhisattva who understands this attains nirvana. So what it's talking about is what the text means by existence here is independent existence, what's sometimes called svabhava in the Mahayana tradition. Self-existing, independently existing, not existing as part of a network of causes and conditions, but existing in and of itself, independent of causes and conditions. And this is the distinction that I think is being made in the passages which seem to be more contradictory. If we take this line from verse 7, they train in the training which is no training. In the Sanskrit, training is shiksha and non-training is ashiksha. And you can read that as Konza did, because the prefix a, I think even if you're not very familiar with Sanskrit, if you've been around the movement and been around order names enough, you'll know that the prefix a is a negation. So we have, for example, mala, which means dirty or impure, and we have amala, which means pure. So amala we have in a lot of order names, and there's other examples as well. So we have shiksha, which is training, and ashiksha, which is a non-training. So if you're saying that the shiksha is an ashiksha, that seems like a paradox. But what Paul Harrison's pointed out is that there are two ways of interpreting words like this in Sanskrit. I'm going to get a little bit technical now, so bear with me. But there are some words, compounds, which are what's called karmadharya, which is basically they're a noun. And we can see examples of this in order names. For example, Sadaraja is a karmadharya, that's a noun, because it means the king of faith. Raja is a noun, it's a king, so he's a king. Yeah, it's quite straightforward. But Ratnaguna, for example, means precious qualities. So you can't say that he is qualities. That doesn't make sense. We say he has qualities. So Ratnaguna is an adjective, but it's kind of nounified. It's turned into a noun. So we translate Ratnaguna's name as he who has precious qualities. And it's the same with this ashiksha. You can interpret it as the training is a non-training, and then it's a logical paradox. Or you can interpret it as, you can interpret ashiksha as not possessing any training, or it doesn't have any training. It's trainingless. And this is, I think, an interpretation of the text that works much better, that avoids this idea that it's a logical paradox. Because what you're saying is that, you know, the bodhisattvas, they train, of course they have this training, but the training isn't, you know, a thing. Don't make the mistake of thinking that it's something independent. Don't reify it. Don't make it an independently existing thing. The training is conditioned. It's impermanent. It's part of the network of causes and conditions. And this is what I think the text is getting at. So if we go back to these, the training is non-training. And again, in verse 3 of chapter 2, the victorious one uses the word state in this way to mean a state which is no state. So we're talking about the state that the bodhisattva should be in. But what this apparent paradox is doing is reminding you, well, you know, don't think that this state is something that exists independently. Remember, this state is impermanent, it's conditioned. So, yeah, that's a. I hope that wasn't too technical, but I think the important point is we should assume that these texts were intended to be understood, and I think what. The paradoxical interpretation is very common in Buddhism, and I think once that interpretation is established, when you read the Sanskrit, it's very hard to read it in a different way because you're affected by the translations you've read before. So I think, you know, Paul Harrison's insight is very valuable, and certainly, you know, if I hadn't read Paul Harrison, I would have translated it in the same way as Konza, because that's what it seems to say. But then reading Paul Harrison's explanation, it's like, oh yeah, no, now I can see another possible meaning in the text, and that actually makes more sense. I'm not completely happy with the way I've translated it, because it's very hard to make this clear in English, so that's why I wanted to talk about it. But another possibility would be that it's a state which is stateless, or a training which is trainingless. But I think I certainly haven't yet found a good way of expressing this concisely in English. So it's maybe necessary just to translate it as it is and provide a commentary. So it's getting near to 5:30, and I think I've said most of the things I'd noted down to say. So we have a little bit of time left. So I thought I'd maybe open up to questions at the end if there's anything I've said about the text, about the process of translation. Or if there's anything you've noticed in the text that you thought, that's a bit weird, or I wonder what's going on there, then feel free to ask.
In some Buddhist texts, we've got they're rendered, they're not translated, they're rendered.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a rendering and a translation?
Well, I think that what people are getting at when they make that distinction is that a translation, that they have this idea that a translation should be very literal, and that a rendering is more free. I would say, from a kind of translation theory background, that they are both translations, but they're different kinds of translations, they're different approaches. And I think both are equally valid, but it depends on the context. So the kind of translation that's appropriate depends on who it's being translated for and how it's going to be used. So if I was translating the Ratnaguna Santrayagata for a Sanskrit language class, I would translate it differently. I would, you know, translate it much more literally. I would keep much more of the Sanskrit syntax to help the students who were reading the Sanskrit and then looking at the translation and using the translation to help them understand the Sanskrit. But translating it here for people who are practicing Buddhists who want to use this text as a support for their practice, you know, I'm going to be reading part of it aloud in the puja as a devotional act, then the kind of translation that you have to have is very different. So I think this difference between translation and rendering comes from people who have this idea that translation should be very literal, that you should have a very literalistic approach to translation, you know, word for word, you know, sticking closely to the syntax, the sentence structure of the original language, which I think is a very narrow and outdated view of what translation is. So I don't think it's necessary to make that distinction between translation and rendering. I think they're just different kinds of translation, both of which are valid in different contexts and for different purposes.
Texts like the Heart Sutra, which we're told was back translated into Sanskrit from Chinese.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a common thing that you have to kind of grasp the different languages to be able to arrive at an actual meaning?
I think the Heart Sutra is a particularly unusual case, because it seems now, and Jayarava is a real expert on this, he's done a lot of research on it, and he's probably one of the people in the world who knows the most about the history of the Heart Sutra. But what it seems to be is that there was a monk in China who was studying the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, and kind of making some notes, you know, like a lot of us would do if we're reading a text. If there's parts that particularly strike us, we would kind of note them down, and so we made this kind of little summary of the bits that he liked from it. And then that became established as its own independent text, the Heart Sutra. And then when Chinese pilgrims, you know, went to India, this is one of the sutras they had with them, and the Indian said, "Oh, we don't have this sutra, it must have been lost, you know, we'll translate it back into Sanskrit." And Jan Natia has written an article where she shows that there are certain kind of quirks in the Sanskrit that show that this has almost certainly been translated from Chinese into Sanskrit. So if you're translating the Heart Sutra, if you're reading the Sanskrit, you kind of have to read the Chinese kind of back into it. And of course the Chinese was itself a translation from the Sanskrit. So that's a particularly kind of complicated case. Unfortunately, that's a very short text. So there's not many texts that have that level of complexity. Most of them have either been written in Sanskrit, or they've usually been written in Prakrit or Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, and some of them have then been Sanskritized. They've taken a text that's written in the more everyday language of Prakrit and kind of, you know, polished it to make it more Sanskritized, to make it sound a bit nicer. Often what you get is that the prose parts will be in Sanskrit, but then the verses will be in Prakrit or Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, because, you know, if you change it into classical Sanskrit, then you mess about with the meter, so you often can't change the verses in the way you can change the prose. And then, I mean, most Buddhist texts that have been preserved are either in Tibetan or Chinese, and the Sanskrit originals have been lost. So when you're reading a Tibetan or a Chinese text that's a translation from Sanskrit, then you do have to... It's very helpful to know Sanskrit, because then you can kind of read... Because you're reading as a translation of Sanskrit, you can kind of see how the Sanskrit's affected the Tibetan or the Chinese. So it can help make sense of it. So a native Chinese speaker trying to read, you know, this text, for example, in Chinese would really struggle, because the Chinese is kind of so Sanskritized. Yeah.
A quick question then, regarding translations from Sanskrit. Is there another modern language besides English that is perhaps more amenable to translation from Sanskrit?
That's a good question. I don't really know. Possibly German. But I think, I mean, even, you know, I live in Scandinavia, and even translating between the different Scandinavian languages, which are basically, you know, they're mutually comprehensible. They're, you know, it's a political question whether they're different languages or dialects of the same language. But, you know, if I'm watching, you know, a Swedish or Danish TV program, it will be subtitled in Norwegian, and there will often be, you know, it's not just a word-for-word translation. Things are changed, you know, the sentences are structured differently, different idioms are used, and those are languages that are so close that, you know, I as a Norwegian speaker can easily have a conversation with a Swedish speaker and we can understand each other. So, possibly Latin. I think if you translate Sanskrit into Latin or Greek, that would probably work much better, because they're classical languages. They're, in terms of structure, very close to Sanskrit. So yeah. I'll maybe recommend that to Padmaloka, that we should start studying these texts in Latin. It's kind of a compromise, you know, between doing English and doing it in Sanskrit. Yeah. Latin's not that hard.
The use of they as a singular pronoun, is it true that there's historical precedent for that, like it's Shakespeare and so forth?
Yeah, it was used by Shakespeare, and it does have quite a long history of usage in English. And if you look on the OED site, you know, Oxford, they have this as a perfectly acceptable and historical use of they. I think the there was a movement in, I'm not quite sure when, but I think particularly in the 19th century to remove this usage, so it then became less popular and seen as incorrect, but it does actually have quite a long historical precedent.
Right.
And I think it works quite well. I mean, I think, I hope when you were reading this text, you didn't notice it. I think it's to me, it's natural enough that if you're not thinking about that, you wouldn't notice that I haven't used he for the bodhisattva, I've used they. So. Well, there's no more questions. If any of you think of anything, do feel free to come and find me and, you know, ask me any particular questions. I'm very happy to have a wee chat about technicalities. I enjoy talking about Sanskrit technicalities. So the only danger is you might have to stop me after a while if I start.